So basically, my calendar is almost empty. Like, I do very few meetings. I have like a few one-on-ones with like the people that report to me, a few like team meetings, and that's about it. So this is like very, very different from like most other organizations. And the reason for this is like we follow this philosophy called asynchronous first, where like most of our communication is actually like in text, it's a written form. And then we only sprinkle in like meetings and retreats. I'm actually going on a retreat to Istanbul next week to meet with the product team and the Android team. So, you know, we still have like some face-to-face meetings, but it's like very limited and very different from like most other organizations.
Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian, and Unicorn Bakery is your podcast to dive deep into the operational war room of being a founder while inviting the best founders and builders globally. Today's guest is Amir Salih Fendic, founder of Doist. You might have used his product Todoist. The company is fully bootstrapped, has no investors, and is doing 20 million euros in annual recurring revenue. The 100-person team is working fully remotely and is working on a so-called maker schedule instead of manager schedule, which will be an important topic because I think a lot of companies here will find themselves working on a manager schedule. We will cover the bootstrap mindset, why European founders think too small, building a generational company, and why revenue per employee can be or should be the most important KPI of a business. And we will cover so much more. Welcome to the show, Amir.
Thank you, Fabian. It's awesome to be here. Yeah, and I'm looking forward for this.
I think most of the people listening have already tried the product Todoist at some point, but I think that doesn't represent everything you do. So you're building the company for 13, 14 years now. So I think summing up how you jumped into the, let's say, journey of becoming a founder and building your own business, etc., is super, super interesting. When did you start? How did you get attracted to being a founder?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, like something to note is like, I was never attracted to becoming a founder or like to starting a company. I was a builder. I'm still a builder. I love to build stuff. So that was kind of the attraction, is actually basically building stuff, like building useful things, like sometimes for myself, but also like I get a lot of like, you know, joy of building stuff for others, like, you know, like creating something valuable in the world. And maybe like since I was like young, like teenage years, I had a lot of projects. Like I was basically an indie hacker, like I don't know, like in 2004, I really started like to do projects, you know, both commercial and just like building stuff, building libraries. Yeah, I, like one of my first like big successes was actually creating one of the first spell checkers online. So actually before, you know, operating system didn't have a built-in spell checker. Browsers as well, like right now we take it for granted. In the beginning, like there was nothing, you know, and you still wanted to have text spell checked. So I actually created like this website where you could basically spell check text, and it grew like quite a lot. I think like I ended up like spell checking like over a billion like types of text in many different languages. So that was kind of like one of the first things that I did that was kind of like that got some scale. Yeah. And same thing with Todoist is like, Todoist actually started in 2007 because I wanted a to-do app for myself. And then it basically like, you know, and also the first like 4 years, I was just building this myself, you know, during the night. Like it was not even like a full-time job for me because, you know, it was just like a passion. Like I really wanted to create something and I used it probably like every day since 2007 as well. So I'm like one of the most active users still. Yeah.
I think it would be hard if you wouldn't be one of the users and pro users yourself and super active. I think then you would lose the traction with the product and it would be super hard to innovate in it or within it.
Exactly. And, you know, something I also learned the hard way is like you really need to pick like product space and a market that you're actually passionate about. Like the thing is like I actually like my real startup once like I actually quit university and like did a startup like everybody does. It was actually a social network. And I worked on that like for maybe 3 years. We actually did have like some scale on that. Like we had like over 10 million users. It's actually still active to this day, which most social networks aren't. But the thing I found out is like, it's called Plurk.
Okay.
Yeah. It's mostly like really big in Taiwan. But the thing I found out is like, you know, like social networks isn't where my passion is. Like I don't really like that idea. I didn't really like the idea of like optimizing for like wasting people's time, because I think maybe like that's one of the problems as well, like why we have had so many issues like with Facebook and Instagram and like TikTok and stuff like that, is I don't think they are aligning, you know, their KPIs towards like, you know, people's happiness KPIs or just like well-being KPIs. And then you kind of end up like with some really, really bad, like very successful products. They make a lot of money, but they're kind of a disaster for society, so for people. So I could like very easily see like, you know, like it's just like I woke up and I hated my job. I hated my life, you know, like so I think it's very like as a founder, like I think it's really, really critical that you pick something that you really love to do and that gives you energy and not like, you know, takes energy away from you.
When was the point when Todoist became your main project instead of the side project? When did it become a company instead of the side project?
Yeah, I mean, something is like I didn't really see that as a big like business or a big project, because for me it was just like a side project. But at some point, like I was actually doing another startup, like a project management, like a collaborative project management solution called Vidoist, and it got like zero traction. And then I looked at Todoist, like, you know, it already had like a lot of users, a lot of paying users, and I was just like, what am I doing here? Like, you know, let's go and focus on this. That's actually where I have traction, where I have like some product market fit. And then once I did that, you know, that was like a like night and day difference, because I kind of committed fully to that. And then I basically like I had it like a side project for like 3 or 4 years. And in this time frame, I actually learned a lot of skills like to building the social network. So when I actually returned back to Todoist, like I could do a lot of stuff. And like, you know, I think I grew maybe like the revenues from like a few thousand dollars per month to like $20,000-$30,000 per month in like less than 6 months. Because, you know, I just came back with a lot of experience and I could just like execute.
Which is amazing. And I think it's super helpful for a lot of founders out there to understand that sometimes it's not the one idea that you're about to make big immediately. It can also evolve over time, because I can imagine that you haven't thought about the adoption. And I think I will imagine it's just product-led growth and word of mouth, that people just love the product and said, hey, you, my friend, also have to use the product, instead of you making or doing a lot of marketing and outreach and everything.
Exactly, Fabian. I think, you know, like, yeah, like, you know, building something that's product market fit is like incredibly hard. Like, you know it, like the way that I actually knew that there was something is like, I would get like these emails from users, and they would basically be like, you know, PhD reports on what things are broken, what I needed to fix. And I was just like, you know, overwhelmed with like feedback. So I think also like sometimes, you know, like, yeah, like we chase the product market fit, and you know, and all times like maybe especially as builders, I think like it's very easy to kind of go in like different directions. And I was also like that in the beginning. You know, I tried very different projects, but sometimes you also need to kind of pause and say, okay, where do I actually need to allocate my time, my energy? Like, what has actually like traction? And then you basically double down on that. Yeah, I see a lot of builders, you know, doing just like many different side projects, you know, mini projects, or like, you know, not investing enough. And I was definitely like that for Todoist, like the first couple of years. But I changed, I feel. Yeah.
I think one question that also comes with your specific business model is, how do you manage growth? Because you attracted millions of users, you have a lot of them not paying for the product, because I can use Todoist for free for the rest of my life if I want to. And at the same time, all the architecture, all the tech, the servers, etc. are coming with it. So how do you manage growth and cost of goods sold versus the growth and making it a sustainable business? How much of the people do have to, like, how much do you optimize on, okay, a certain amount of people have to pay for the full product, otherwise we can't run our services. So how do you manage all that?
I mean, something to note with us is like we have actually been profitable, I think, for all years of operation, you know. So actually like managing that isn't really a huge problem. Yeah, and the reason is, you know, like our biggest cost is actually people. It's not really tech, you know. It's like the salaries that we pay to people. And tech, you know, it's like, especially like as you know, cloud has scaled and like services have become much cheaper. Like it's not, it's still a significant cost. You know, we pay a lot for that, but it's not like there's no real competition on that. And, you know, for us also, like as a company, what we actually want is kind of also impact. So like we want, you know, an impact in terms of like how many people are we affecting, you know, how many people are we helping, and not only, you know, how much revenue do we have. So those are kind of always like the balance elements. And definitely, you know, we could probably be like have a lot more revenues if we're much more aggressive in terms of like monetization. But, you know, I don't really think like we need to do that. Like, and that is not really a driver for us either. And also right now, like we actually like thinking about this very differently as well, because like we're actually like 2 days ago, we announced like our move into like a more collaborative space and more like company and team, like project management instead of just like individual one. And honestly, I think for us, like eventually, like I think that would be our core business model. So like for individuals, it will probably be free. And then we're going to make it up with like, you know, helping like teams and companies organize and get stuff done. So this is how we look at this. Yeah. But honestly, like, you know, the monetization part is not really like the thing that is like motivating us. This said, we have actually hired some people that really care a lot about like monetizing. And it's great to have a balance. But like most people inside this, like we like craftsmanship, building great products, having users that use our products, you know, that love using our products. Like that is the motivator. And then, you know, of course, like you need to have also somebody that pays for your product as well, because then you're not sustainable.
Yeah. What are the big changes that you had to prepare for the last months that because of the change that you're like, you're not focusing on prosumers anymore and consumers anymore? It's still a large target audience for you, but you said you're shifting the focus a bit more towards business customers. And what were the preparations for that? How did it look like? Did you have to restructure the organization a bit? Did you have to restructure processes, teams? What happened through the last months?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And also, like, I don't think, like, we have done this transformation yet. So we are kind of in the process of doing that. But also something to remember as well is, like, we actually still want to be world-class at, like, helping the individual organize themselves. Because, you know, in a company or in a team setting, you still want to, you know, start with, like, organized and productive individuals before you can have, like, a organized and productive team. So that's kind of our core thesis. And it's actually not, like, anybody in the market that actually solves this right now. Like if you look at Asana or like Monday or ClickUp or some other of these tools, like they're just focusing on like team and company, and the individual, you know, they don't really care about them. So our thesis is really like we still want to be world-class at the individual level and then like add the collaborative aspect at the top. They said, you know, like taking a product from like a single player mode to multiplayer mode, like that is a big challenge, because a lot of the stuff that we kind of like, a lot of like the architecture things that we did initially was optimized towards the individual, and then suddenly you need to like recreate everything to make it like optimized for the collaborative use case. And you know, it's like we have been in this like not rewrite, but basically refactoring of the core models, core APIs for the last like 3 years, and we are finally now kind of like at the end of this tunnel, you know, like we can see the light. But it has been super, super tough. And, you know, I think like the steps afterwards is kind of like phrase like, I think for B2B, like customer success, much more critical. Sales, we have like zero salespeople right now. That's something we need to become better at. And, you know, I'm actually like very interested to learning about this. And, you know, like, yeah, so I've already begun to read a lot and just like learn a lot about like this new things that we need to become great at. But, you know, I think it's a challenge. And I think, you know, as a lot of like this, like the market has shifted a lot, I think. And I think like in order to actually build something really successful, you actually need to be great at many things. You need to be great at product. You need to be great at sales, to support, at marketing. Maybe, you know, like 5 years ago, you could just be great at sales, you know, and you had a shitty product, but you have a great sales force. That work. I think right now, like you need to kind of be world class at everything, which, you know, puts the bar super high.
Yeah, I recently listened to an interview at on Lenny's podcast with the CPO of Calendly, and it seems like the product journey is quite the same from the personal character that is using the product, then professionalizing it for more of the business use, and also more and more, and then at some point teams also want to use it. It's not that you, and it's the same for you, you're not coming up with, oh, let's figure out if teams want to use it. I think teams naturally started using it and now want to have more professionalized additions and features and everything and collaborative work options. So it seems to be like a similar story and product journey. So if you haven't, I can recommend listening to the episode. I can send you the link afterwards. And for every listener, I will put it in the show notes, because I think it's super interesting to see from a product perspective how they also structured teams and everything. Let's go a bit more into, because we you said, okay, we're not only focused on money, not only focused on revenue, but still you grew to a certain size that a lot of businesses, no matter how much valuation they have, are not. And you mentioned in other podcasts that one of your key metrics is revenue per employee, that you look that your team is not overgrowing and outgrowing the revenue growth. Can you give us a bit more insight when you started looking at this KPI and how it developed over time?
Yeah, Fabian, that is a great question, and I'm actually not sure when this became relevant for us. But you know, I think like there's a lot of like vanity metrics, like for instance, valuation. I think it's a vanity metric, like the amount of money you raised, and I think there's a lot of like ways you can kind of like inflate those things. So you see, like with this like market correction, which I think is super healthy, is kind of like, you know, we are kind of like getting down to like the core, which is basically, you know, you need to have a productive team. And I think like the best way to judge a productive team is like revenue per employee. So that's kind of like why I think it is a key metric, and it should be a key metric for organizations. And another thing that I think has also been like really, really bad in our market is kind of like just like no focus on the fundamentals, you know, because yeah, like you can grow a lot if you just burn money, you know, but like at some point you actually need to start earning money. And I don't think like this is a switch that you just like turn on and off. I think it's really like something that needs to be ingrained in the organization. And even like if you look at the best companies in the world, you know, like let's say Google, and maybe they're still not the best because they are really inefficient right now. Still earn a lot of money, but really inefficient in terms of like their productivity, is that, you know, they were really, really, really effective businesses. Like they didn't raise a lot of money. They didn't burn a lot of money, you know. And I think we sometimes forget, like, you know, it's not like like Google, of course, like they had some years where they kind of needed to find a business model. But once they did, it was basically scaling and they were earning a ton of cash. And I feel like a lot of like these current businesses that we have today are not really doing that. And I don't think like they can do a switch because, you know, they're just, for instance, in our market, just to say the brewery market, there's a lot of like just like crappy products that have like very bad retention. But they're basically like buying a lot of traffic and buying a lot of users, you know. And at some point, like you that stops to work, and then you have like huge problem because you're still left with a bad product. Yeah. So that's kind of like my take on this, is like you kind of like need to really hone in on like efficiency, especially like in the current market, you know, like where you will not have like investors just like pour money to you, you know. And I think this is super healthy, and I think we will get like much better businesses, much better companies, much more productive companies, better products as well. Because, you know, if you just can't burn money like stupidly, you actually need to build something that works, that actually solves people's problems, that retains people, you know. Yeah.
Was there a situation that you have in mind or that comes to your mind where you had the feeling that this revenue per employee and other very important KPIs for you are out of place and you have to rework and refocus to make things happen? And if there is such a situation, how was it? What was it like?
I mean, the thing to know is like we have always operated in this way. And the reason is like I learned something like really critical in the social network. Is that like in the social network, we didn't have a business model. We were basically just burning cash, you know. And then at some point, we actually tried to make a business model and it didn't work. And we tried like many different things, it didn't work. So that's why like in the current, like in the next iteration of company, I was like, you know, I want to have a business model that works, you know, like that is actually sustainable. And I also don't really want to like, I mean, also I have like some really horrific like VC, like investor stories from the social network as well that I took with me. And I said like, I don't want to depend on investors, you know. So that's why we kind of like have this very different, I think, model than most other companies in our market, you know. like it's much more focused on sustainable growth on like core, you know, building a business that's actually sustainable than, you know, just like growth at all costs and stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, what I can kind of like see is I can kind of compare the thing we are doing with the thing that the market was doing. And I think like the market is actually shifting more in our position right now, which I think is like healthy. Yeah.
What is one of the crazier stories from VC land that you still have in mind and remember when you're thinking about the social network time?
Yeah, I mean, it should be said that I lived actually in Taiwan and I raised money from Chinese VCs.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, that was pretty, that was a very, very bad experience because like they are very old school. And also like, there's just like a different culture and vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also like, I don't want to kind of like throw anybody under the bus, but it's just like, for me, it kind of like made it clear that like, you know, I felt like I was begging for money, you know, or like, and they were kind of like a class on top of like the founder class. You know, I think of course, like this was like in 2008 or 9 or something like that. Like a lot of stuff has changed. I think like there's a lot more like equality. But before, you know, like the VCs were the gods, you know, like they gave you money, and like if they didn't give you money, you were in deep trouble. And they could also like fire you and set, like there was just like a very bad environment. And then like, of course, right now, especially like in the US, I feel like in the Europe, like there's still this mentality, you know, which isn't very good. And I know, you know, a lot of like my friends are Europeans where, you know, they're working with some really, really bad investors, you know. They're kind of like adding negative value to the company, super toxic to work with, you know. So I feel like, you know, the market has evolved a lot over like when I started, and probably right now you can find some partners that are very good and they will help you out. But obviously, even still right now, like I think sometimes like meeting with the VCs, I think like a lot of them don't really know what they're talking about, you know. Yeah, so like being, you know, some kind of like banker before and like giving you tips on product building, I'm just like, yeah, like this isn't really very useful and you don't really know what you're talking about. Yeah.
What would you say are the biggest hurdles of bootstrapping your company instead of taking money from investors, with which we you covered quickly what burdens you have then, but what are the hardest and toughest things about bootstrapping a business?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think like you have the same problem as you had with the VC route, is like finding product market fit is incredibly difficult. I don't think there's like a formula you can follow, because if there was, you know, like everybody will have like $1 billion business, you know. So true. It's kind of like, you know, you need to kind of find something very unique, and you need to have like energy and time and money to actually do that. So definitely understand like why the VC route can be very helpful, because you have the initial capital you can kind of like invest off. But I think like it's the same struggle. And of course, like if you have the means of like starting something yourself and bootstrapping it, I think like there's less pressure, you know, you can have more time to do that. You could do it as a side project. And then like once you kind of like can smell the product market fit, you have some customer, you get some feedback, then you kind of like go more and more into it. So like if I started from now, like, you know, like from scratch, I would probably try to, you know, have a job and then do something on the side and try to kind of catch the product market fit.
Yeah.
And also like, I'm not really against like raising money, like even if it's seed money, I think it can, but I really think like you need to be careful who you partner with and what the structure is.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when I started, there was no information either about this. And right now, like, we have so much information, and even like, you know, a lot of the terms, like for instance, like YC, Combinators, terms sheets, you know, there's a lot of like just standardization that there were in the past. Like in the past, you could get some really, really bad terms that are kind of like, you know, like handicap you for the rest of your journey. And I think right now it's not really happening. So honestly, you know, yeah, I mean, I think the most challenging part of bootstrapping is like finding product market fit. Yeah. And I think like you have this problem regardless of which route you take. So yeah.
When did you have the feeling of product market fit? How did you know, okay, there is something we actually, in quotation marks, made it.
Yeah. I mean, right now, I think, again, like, for instance, you mentioned Lenny's newsletter or podcast. I mean, there's like so much like content there. And if you read through that, like, you'll be an expert, like, on a lot of these topics, you know, and there's like so much experience and, you know, like knowledge there that just wasn't possible or like wasn't accessible before. So I think definitely you can take advantage of that. And there's also even a formula you can use to figure out like if you have found product market fit. I think like Lenny actually has a newsletter on that. So you can basically follow that. But honestly, I think it's basically like, you know, finding something that I think for me personally, like I really need to be passionate about what I'm building. So like I need to use something myself and be excited about that. So that for me is like the first product market fit. Like, is this something I would be passionate about? And the reason for this is I think it's very, very hard to actually build something for other people. It's much easier to actually start with a problem you have than like trying to solve other people's problems. That's at least, you know, the formula I have used so far. And of course, like in a lot of settings, this doesn't really work. Like, you know, if you're building something for doctors, but you're not a doctor yourself, you know, you kind of like need to do a lot of other stuff like user research and blah, blah, blah to kind of figure out that aspect. But, you know, using yourself and then like having, you know, some users that are super passionate about that, I think that's also a really clear sign. Having people pay you for it. So something, you know, is like, I had actually a business model to do this in 2007 because I didn't want to pay for the hosting of the service. And people started to pay, you know, because they found it useful. And I think that's also like, that's probably the best way to judge like product market is like, are people actually willing to pay you to use your service or not?
Absolutely. Very valid point. And I think a lot of startups do this too late. They are just like, oh yeah, let's just get in some people. And then at some point we will turn on monetization and then it will work. And for a lot of cases, this is not the case. And therefore, I think trying to figure this out quite early is super important, especially in current market conditions.
If I may, could I add just something? I think like that's super, super critical. And also something that like revenues give you is like optionality. You know, you can keep going the bootstrap way. Also like revenues, it's much easier to raise money, especially the revenues are growing fast. You know, so it just gives you like an edge. Like without revenues, you have really deep problems, you know, and you're just like dependent on investors. And right now in this current market, like it's very hard to raise money, you know. So without revenues, you're in deep trouble. But even in good times, I think it's still very good to actually create something that people value so much that they want to pay you for it. I think that's kind of the golden standard of like, are you creating value in the world? Is like, are people like willing to give you value? Perfect.
Absolutely. I'm super sure that in the good times, you would have easily had the ability to raise a growth round. Like, let's say 20, 50, 100 million to grow further and increase everything and pour some oil in the fire and like make it bigger. And why didn't you? Why did you say, okay, no, we stick to what we do. We will not. Because the one thing is taking VC money in the beginning. The second thing is having something that could be with increased growth. Supported by VC. And because you said VC is a tool and it could have been a good tool to grow further. Why did you decide in the best times that we had in, I'd say, 15 years, 2 years ago, you decided not to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And the thing to note is like, I don't actually think we are blocked by capital. So that's probably the reason why. And also like, we really love to be independent, you know, like we can do anything that we want. We have total freedom. We can build any kind of company we want, any kind of structure we want. And for me, you know, as a founder, and like that is really, you know, I do this not only for the money's sake, I do this also for the freedom, you know, like especially I do this, like we have a very, very special culture. And I was like, you know, of course, pandemic helped a lot. But even in the past, like we were remote first, like in 2011, you know, most VCs thought you could only be like in these, you know, startup capitals like, you know, San Francisco, or London or Berlin or whatever, like you couldn't really do like remote first. So stuff like that. And even right now, like we have a lot of stuff that you know, we can just like have optionality. And also, yeah, I'm not really against like raising money. I think like if you have some great partners, they can help you a lot. A lot of the VCs are also smart as well. But I also think, you know, like the goal is really to build a great business, a sustainable business, a growing business. It's not to raise money. And I think like we have maybe like conflicted these two, especially, you know, there's some companies that like are like have shit businesses. They've already raised a lot of money. And I don't really understand that. And I think this will not end very well because, yeah, on the long run, it's really about like building something that's sustainable. And you know, yeah. So, yeah, I hope I answered that.
Absolutely. It's just interesting to understand like the how deeply the bootstrap mindset is rooted in your head. And it's totally understandable. I think a lot of founders have to hear about this more often to make their proper decision, because we're always talking about VCs and raising money, etc. And it feels like the only option when it isn't by far. And therefore, digging deeper into these mindset is super important.
I mean, spot on. Yeah. And I think, you know, like, again, I think actually like the best VCs or investors are your customers, you know, like, and we have always been driven by our customers, like paying us money. And it creates like really nice, like alignment, because, you know, you really need to build stuff for your customers, you know, like you're not building stuff for like, VCs or, you know, like investors or like stock, holders, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of a different mindset, but honestly, like I'm not really against any of these. I think there are different paths, there are tools you can use. Sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't make sense. Yeah. I do think though there's like, or there has been like way too much focus on like fundraising and way little focus on actually building sustainable and growing businesses. And I think that's what it's about. Like, yeah.
I think a lot of founders who've started 5 years ago or during the last 5 years will only see who were actually building great businesses in the next 5 years when everything is getting harder and only the companies survive that are really built on fundamentals instead of just good fundraisers and storytellers. But let's see. I have to admit, I only do this for 6 years, so I have no clue myself. I'm trying to figuring out and fostering out, fostering things and understanding and finding the trees in the forest, but it's not that easy. So let's see. In 5 years, we can have this discussion, and I have the feeling of some experience then. But until then, I'm just observing. You mentioned a lot how important productivity is for you and for the whole team, and I would love to, and you're working fully remote. So how do you define a productive company?
Yeah, I mean that's a great question, Fabian. And honestly, like, you know, the core thesis of Doist is that the way that we are working is broken. So actually, we want to fix that. And that's basically what we have tried to do. And like, we have tried to do this, like, with the remote first approach, asynchronous first. Like, we mostly communicate in text inside a company. We are still not there. You know, I don't think we have found the formula. And something actually, like, we had a leadership retreat in Amsterdam, like a few months ago. Something we kind of like talked a lot about is like, we have focused a lot on communication, but actually something that's like more broken is maybe like planning and executing. So maybe, you know, a productive team or productive company is a company that's like good at planning, good at executing, and good at communicating. Yeah. And especially, you know, from our side, I think there's been way too little focus on like, how do we become better at planning and executing? And that's something like we will focus a lot more on. Yeah. And of course, like the communication piece is also like something that has been a huge topic, but I feel like a lot of the discussions around this are really about like communicating, you know, should you communicate using Slack inside meetings, you know, but we're not really like talking about like what's maybe even more critical is like, how do you plan stuff? How do you execute stuff? And what I see in the market is like, there's a lot of spreadsheets going around. And it's like, it feels like, you know, we have not really evolved on this front for the last, like, I don't know, 20, 30 years. And of course, there's like some tools, for instance, like ClickUp or whatever. But yeah, I think we can do a lot better in this space. Yeah.
Let's go a bit into tactics here. Take us into a typical day or a typical week, and tell us a bit about how you work, how your schedule looks, because I think it looks different from most of the people out there.
Yeah, I mean, I did an interview with Avery, which is kind of like a newsletter. And the title was like the CEO that has an empty calendar or something like that. So basically, my calendar is almost empty. Like I do very few meetings. I have like a few one-on-ones with like the people that report to me. A few like team meetings, and that's about it. So this is like very, very different from like most other organizations. And the reason for this is like we follow this philosophy called asynchronous first, where like most of our communication is actually like in text, it's in written form. And then we only sprinkle in like meetings and retreats. I'm actually going on a retreat to Istanbul next week to meet with the product team and the Android team. So, you know, we still have like some face-to-face meetings, but it's like very limited and very different from like most other organizations. And honestly, for me, you know, I'm also a dad of three small kids. This is amazing. Like it gives you so much freedom. And, you know, we have also like removed like this Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Like we actually don't really have any schedules. You know, you can work whenever you want. The only requirement we do is like you need to respond to people in 24 hours, you know, which gives you a lot of like flexibility. And especially, you know, like we come back to this, what you said in the intro, it's kind of like managers versus, you know, creator. I'm not sure how Paul Graham calls it, but manager versus maker. Yeah. And basically we run on the maker schedule, you know, and this is like super great for like the people that are doing deep work. We pay a lot to engineers. They can do a lot of deep work using this. They don't need to be like in these stupid like meetings, stand-up meetings, and you know, like status update meetings. We're just focusing and solving hard problems. Yeah, so that's one aspect. And I think like we are still kind of like becoming better at this. Another aspect is also like people are really, really happy in the structure. So like if you look at our side, like I think like our employee retention over the last like 5 to 10 years is like over 90%. Almost nobody leaves this because I really think like people love like all the freedom this gives them. And also the creators love this because they can kind of focus on their craft, focus on, you know, an engineer loves to solve hard problems. They don't love to be in like 5 hour meetings per day, you know.
What tools do you use for the asynchronous or asynchronic communication? How do you structure the text form? Is it email? Is it documents? Is it can also be Notion? I don't know.
I mean, we use our own tool called Twist. Yeah. So we have built something. Again, you know, like we and that's, you know, so the story behind Twist is like we actually didn't want to do another tool. Like if you read like a lot of like strategy books, like nobody will recommend you, like you have a problem, you have something that's successful, you have a problem, then you solve another problem as well. Because it has been a huge investment to actually do Twist. But the problem is like in 2014, when we actually looked at this, like nobody was doing asynchronous tools. Like nobody was even thinking about that. So, you know, you had Slack, you have Microsoft copying Slack with Teams, Atlassian also like copied them. But it was all like real-time chat, like chit-chat. And we're just like, we want actually something that like is more long-form, more structured, not real-time. So that's what we built. Yeah. So that's one element of that. Another element that I think is like super critical for like asynchronous first or remote first organization or any organization is like handbook. Like you need to have a handbook and you need to kind of maintain that handbook. I think like GitLab is a great example. They have like written a lot about that. They have made their handbook with like tens of thousands of pages public. So you can go in there. But I think like that is really, really also critical. It's kind of like having, you know, the handbook where you kind of like have more permanent knowledge. So there we have like company values, strategy, like 3-year strategy, you know, everything that's kind of like more permanent, it goes to the handbook.
That's, by the way, what I meant in the beginning, that Doist is more than just Todoist. And shame on me that I didn't know about Twist, but I could have thought about it. Sorry for that. I will also link it in the show notes. I opened the website in the meantime, and sounds amazing. At first, I have to have a deeper look, but I will link it to everybody so that they can understand what you meant by its build for asynchronous communications. And one last question, talking tactics about your schedule. What meetings are worth meeting for, and how do you prioritize? How do you decide if a meeting is necessary so that people also can learn to reevaluate their meetings?
Yeah, I mean, like something to know is like, I think it's actually critical to become better at meetings, especially as the company grows. So for instance, like all of our meetings actually have an agenda. We keep that in to-do list, like agenda, actionables. And if there's no agenda, like I'm not taking that meeting. And even like if there's an agenda, like I want to have like the agenda with content. So I can kind of see like, you know, I can prepare beforehand to kind of think about stuff. Like I don't like to go into a meeting and need to think fast, you know, and make decisions fast. Same goes like I'm just talking for myself, but like the same goes for the whole do list. Like we don't do meetings if there's no agenda. And the same thing is like with actionables. Like if you decide something in the meeting, like it should be added as a task assigned to a person, possibly with a date on like when is this due. So that's basically the basic structure. And I think like the meetings that are worth taking, and I was like, so Andy Grove, he was a CEO of Intel. He did this amazing book called High Output Management. It's from the 80s, I think. When I read that, I actually read about like how he did the one-on-ones. And before that, we didn't actually have one-on-ones. So I read that book and I think we implemented one-on-ones, and that was like amazing transformation to the whole organization. So I think definitely having one-on-ones, being good at one-on-ones is really worth investing into. Yeah, and then like maybe you can also do like some group meetings as well. And the reason why I think like, but you know, you should not overdo it. That's something like, you know, like I think you sprinkle them in. For us, like we work in squads. I think like it makes sense to meet like monthly to just sync up, like see people, we talk about problems, like see, because you can do that in text. And we do that a lot in text, like status updates, all status, like weekly status updates are in text. But it's kind of like high level, you know, alignment is quite critical as well. And I think also like real, like meeting people in real life is super critical. Like if you're running a remote organization, I think like it's one of the keys to success. Like if you don't do that, yeah, it's very, very hard to kind of connect with people, you know.
Fair enough. Thanks for sharing. Last part of the show, I would love to talk about ambition and building generational companies, because I think most of the founders don't. They, especially the VC companies, of course, have in mind, okay, what is our exit channel? And most of the times it's not the IPO to build it forever. It's often in Europe, let's put it that way. So how do you think about the right ambition to building a company? What does that mean for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Fabian. And something to note is, I think like this depends on like your experience, but maybe even next, I'm not sure if experience should actually go into this. But for me personally, like, I think it's very, very critical, or it was very critical to find a problem that I could spend my life on. So that's kind of like, you know, I think maybe a presentation, like a blog post I've written is like, you know, my exit strategy from this is debt. So that's like the commitment level. Like I don't plan to exit, and when I exit, it will basically be like when I die, which isn't like really like it's very, very uncommon for founders to have this kind of like commitment. But like if you say, okay, this is my commitment, then you go and pick your market. If you know that you're committed like for a lifetime, of course, this is like very extreme, and maybe like most like maybe you can be a bit inspired by this. yeah, because I don't think like this is for everybody. And I understand like people burn out, you know, you maybe don't want to do something like for your whole life. But I just think like it's very, very critical that you deeply connect with what you're working on, and you like pick something that you can work on for at least a decade or two. Because if you look at like any kind of like success, you know, you need to spend a lot of time on this, like decades, you know. There's not a lot of like companies, like maybe if you're super lucky, but it's kind of like, do you really want to like put your life on like a lottery ticket? You know, heck, I don't want to do that, you know. So for me, that is kind of like the commitment level. And I think like, especially in Europe, I think a lot of founders, they're just like picking something that can like exit or like make them rich. And I think that's like a completely bad way. I understand like why they want to do that. Like it's stressful work. You want some money, you know, you want some success. But I think actually we would have much better businesses, much better companies, much better founders if you kind of try to like optimize for the long term and, you know, pick the market, pick the product, you know, pick something that speaks to you and you can commit yourself to the long term. Yeah. And even right now, like if you look at the really successful founders, you know, they all have like a bigger mission, you know, like phrases. Yeah. I mean, maybe it can sound like with Elon Musk, like, of course, like he's not very popular with the Twitter drama and like what he's doing there. But I think like he has done some amazing things with the SpaceX, you know, it's not like just, you know, let's just send some satellites to and earn some money. It's kind of like, yeah, go to Mars. Like that's a freaking, yeah, a very long term and very hard mission. And I think we could get inspired by that.
You mentioned, or we talked about it, Todoist has been a side project in the beginning, and now you're, okay, I'm doing Todoist until the rest of my life, or for the rest of my life. What was it? We mentioned it was a side project. I can't imagine it not from the first day onward. You were like, oh, I will do this for the rest of my life. So when was the transition? Because I'm thinking about it. Was it in the moment where you're like, okay, there is some success. If I maintain the success and grow from here, I can do it for the rest of my life? Or was it clearly your ambition before you reached the point of, if I'm sticking to it or maintaining this level of success and increase it, I should be fine?
That's a great question and also a great reflection. And the thing is, like, maybe initially, like, you need to do some exploration, you know, because, like, maybe you don't really know what you're signing up for. For instance, like, it would have been a huge mistake if I said, like, you know, building a social network in Asia, that's, like, what I want to do the rest of my life. You know, I would be miserable today if I did that. So maybe there's, like, some reflection, some exploration that needs to happen. But I think, you know, that's at least something I've like found out is like you need to search for that. And once you find it, then you become like really happy because you kind of find your spot, you know. For instance, like for me, like I go to work and I'm super excited every day because I really love what we do. You know, and I think it can be very hard to do that if you don't really like the market or the product that you're in or the culture you have built. And a lot of founders and like are also like building, you know, companies they don't want to work in, you know. So maybe like this is not really like something that you kind of like, say, okay, from one day to another, like, yeah, this is like what I want to do, but more like exploring, you know, and that can maybe be the goal. It's kind of like, can you find something that you're actually willing to spend your life on? And that is maybe the quest. And maybe you will not find that. And that's also okay. And maybe, you know, because, yeah, like that can also happen. But maybe like having that as like an ambition level could be very good. At least for me, like, that gave so much clarity when I actually began to think about that.
One thing that I saw over the last years with a lot of calls and meetings with European founders versus US founders is that in Europe, it feels like IPO is the end goal. Let's talk ventures now for like VC-backed ventures. IPOs are the end goal, and then founders tend to move out slowly after. And in the US, it seems to be the starting point. There are so many founders who really started like doubling down on what they've built after the IPO. And in Europe, it feels, and maybe, and there are, please prove me wrong with all the examples also in comments and via messages, whatever. But it feels different when I talk to people. Also, VCs are like super happy, like, okay, IPO is the end goal. We don't want to stick with companies for longer. And then you have also US VCs with Union Square Ventures, et cetera, that take like 18 years to close their funds and return it because they said, okay, we will wait until a certain amount of time. And it feels so different from the mindset. And therefore, the ambition also seems to like be super, super different because people are like, okay, that's my end goal versus, okay, then I'm getting started and it's like taking really crazily off. I'm not sure where this will lead and if this changes when the ecosystem gets older and stronger and more experienced and we have more people IPOing or had more people IPOing and not only in the best window ever, but also like then maintaining on the stock markets. But that's just one observation that I have where I'm like, okay, I have no clue what this means and what implications it has for the long run. It's just what I see and that concerns me a bit.
I mean, for sure. I think like, you know, if you look at like the most valuable tech companies of all, like Europe is like very far from that. Like we have only a few companies on that list. Spotify is maybe one.
I'm actually unsure like how many others we have.
which is really depressing, you know, because we have so many talented people, so many talented founders. Like we should have a lot more of these. So there's definitely something that's like broken. And I think like the ambition level should be like much, much higher. So, you know, it could be like very good to kind of reflect on what is actually broken and what can we fix. And maybe, you know, like we are satisfied with very little, you know. So even, you know, I think, you know, maybe one of the reasons why we haven't like created much bigger companies is like people are just satisfied with like exiting, either selling or IPOing. And then afterwards, just kind of like, yeah, okay, I've made it, you know. But yeah, I believe like we need to change this because I think it kind of hurts our economies, you know, our collective economies. It hurts that we don't have, you know, Google or like Microsoft here. Like we do have like some like old companies like SAP and stuff like that. But honestly, like it's like very minimal. And especially as how the market shifts, it's kind of like more and more knowledge work. And we don't seem to be able to produce, you know, really successful like knowledge work companies. Like maybe this can shift. And yeah, I would definitely like love to see, you know, having like much more ambitious European founders and like, you know, also people that are committed, like, you know, post IPO or whatever, like, you know, let's build some freaking amazing companies. And yeah, you know, and I also think we have a lot of stuff that is like really good for us. Like, you know, the education, healthcare system of Europe are amazing. I think we have so much talent, you know, and I think we can compete on a global scale. And I think we can actually compete against like the Chinese, the Indians and the Americans. Yeah.
Let's end this on a high note with the pros of Europe. Amir, it's been a super pleasure to have you on the show. It was an amazing conversation. I'm super thankful that you took the time. I'm very impressed when you're building with Doist for such a long time and how you're like also thinking about the future. And that definitely inspires me to like think about how do I want to live my life and think about what to build, what not to build. So thank you very much for taking the time. I would love to hand over the last words of the podcast for you to give a last note for the founders out there, last words that you want to share. From my side, huge thank you.
Fabian, this has been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show. And the last note is, you know, yeah, I mean, I think we should just like continue building, having high ambition, having optimism as well. I see like a lot of pessimism, you know, and honestly, like I'm super optimist. I think like all of the challenges that we have can be solved. I think technology is one way we can achieve that, you know, like learning, growing, having ambition, you know, building. That's that. What I focus on and I hope like, you know, a lot of other will focus on as well.
Thank you so much.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Falls dir diese Folge gefallen hat, dann musst du auf jeden Fall mal den Unicorn Bakery WhatsApp Newsletter auschecken. Dort bekommst du ein bis zweimal die Woche von mir entweder eine persönliche Sprachnotiz oder eine Content-Empfehlung, Blogpost, Video etc. für Dinge, die du als Gründer unbedingt wissen, lesen, hören musst. Am einfachsten ist es, du klickst auf den Link in der Beschreibung und meldest dich an. Ansonsten kannst du auch auf jungunternehmerpodcast.com/newsletter gehen.